So we're here today. I'm joined by Dr. James Rogers. Once again, thank you very much for coming on.
Not a problem at all. Happy to be back.
And he's here today to talk about an obscure part of history, but nonetheless interesting, fascinating, drone warfare. So I'll start off by asking you a question, James. Why would you say is drone warfare so relevant today?
Oh, wow. I mean, it's more relevant now than it has been perhaps for a decade or so. If we look at those botched US drone strikes in Kabul late last, the accidental killing of 10 civilians, and then we just look to the most recent attacks with the terrorist use of drones across the Middle East, then we can start to see that drone warfare is not only incredibly important if we want to understand modern warfare, but it's something that's going to grow in importance over the coming years. I mean, we're at a point now where at least 102 different nation states, and by my latest calculations, probably around 60, 70 different non-state actors, that is terrorists and criminal gangs, have weaponized drone capabilities. So any future war, Charlie, is going to have a drone component to it.
Right. Okay. That's very fascinating. I read in the news about the Kabul airstrikes, and I think in 2011, is that right? They used them. Was that in Afghanistan? Am I right in saying under the Obama?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yes. So if we go back and we look at the Obama administration, we have to think that President Obama came to power at a really interesting time for the United States. It was, you know, 2009, he'd made a promise to the American people that he would withdraw them from the illegal war in Iraq and win the good war in Afghanistan. And all of these wars, of course, are part of the war on terror, which was waged very much in revenge for 9/11, those attacks on the World Trade Centers and the Pentagon on September 11th, 2001. But by promising the American people that he would remove troops out of harm's way, his promise to the American people that they wouldn't have to put up with the body bags coming home of their best, their brightest, their youngest, their mothers, their daughters, their sons, their husbands. By making that promise, Charlie, he'd left himself in a bit of a perilous and tricky situation, because how was it that the United States would continue to fight terror globally, but without deploying troops? Well, it's here that he found a panacea in the use of armed military drones, like the Predators and the Reapers that we perhaps most associate with drone warfare today. And this is something that he continued to use hundreds of times during the war on terror in Afghanistan, and then broadened and widened the war on terror to include places like Somalia and Yemen and Pakistan. And so you started to see a global war on terror that became a global drone war on terror.
Right. Okay. So if we take it into very, very modern context right now, what's going on in Russia and in their potential invasion of Ukraine, could we see Russia using that kind of technology on Ukraine, perhaps?
Or could we see Ukraine using that kind of technology on Russia? Yeah. Now, one of the really interesting things about drones is that as they proliferate, as they spread to a range of actors globally, then they're providing nation states, smaller nation states and non-state actors with a capability that they've never been able to afford before, and one that they're just not usually trained well enough to use. It's really hard to have an air force. You need to have trained pilots. You need to have a whole generation of training schools. You need doctrine and strategy and the ability to upkeep these incredibly sophisticated piloted jets and fighter bombers. With drones, you don't need that. We've reached a point in history now where it's relatively easy to take command and control of a drone system. They're augmented sometimes with commercial operating technologies, which have made it so much easier for even a bit of an idiot like me to get their drone license. And this is the worrying aspect for it, but also the formatory aspect in terms of modern warfare, because after Ukraine had been invaded in 2014 with the earlier Russian incursions and the deployment of little green men and women, as we remember from that period, well, Ukraine took a really quite strategic choice to invest in developing drone systems. This was their way that they could deploy air power and pinpoint precision strikes against a Russian military. And they started using these really early on. They created their own industry, their own factories, and they started imported drones from around the world. Most recently, you've started to see Turkey selling drones to Ukraine. And so if there was ever to be an incursion by Russia, which at this moment and time as we're recording there hasn't been, but there might well be, then Russia has to be prepared for the first time in a long time to face hostile strikes from above. When was the last time that Russia faced hostile air power? I mean, I couldn't tell you off the top of my head. Was it potentially the Korean War? Was it the Second World War? When was it, Charlie?
I honestly was just going to suggest World War II after the Operation Barbarossa. But it's really quite incredible the way that drone warfare is really revolutionizing the way we're going to be fighting in, you know, the not so distant future. And even has started to do that. But I think we should wind back the clock a bit. So when did drone warfare really begin?
It's a good question. Yes, it is a good question, a solid question for any history podcast, and one that I love to answer because it's one that I was most surprised about. So when I first started doing my research into this many, many years ago now, I wanted to trace back the history of drone warfare and precision warfare, this idea of precision strike. And I thought I'd probably be able to take it back to the Gulf War in the 1990s and the use of early pioneer drones as they use them. And these drones during the Gulf War against Saddam Hussein were sent up above Saddam's troops to pick out targets. And then they'd fly back to the ships that were launching cruise missiles, like the USS Iowa and Wisconsin. And they would relay their information, and that would take time to put it together. And then the ships would be able to change their positioning and direct their fire more precisely. And they did this so effectively, being able to improve the precision of strikes and the lethality of American strikes, that during the Gulf War, we had an incident where every time Saddam's troops saw a drone in the sky, they would try and surrender to it because they knew precision strikes were coming in. And what this means is that it was the first time in the history of warfare that humans tried to surrender to robots. Now, that could be our starting point here, right? It's most certainly the starting point of what we might call more modern drone warfare. But let's take it back. We go back to Vietnam. We started to see thousands of drones being used in Vietnam. They were called lightning bugs, and they were used alongside crewed aircraft, so these piloted bombers. And what they were used is kind of in a what we call a loyal wingman capacity. So they would fly alongside the crewed bombers, and they would either be sent off and launched and to hit a target, or they would be acting as a kind of shield because they would be acting as a target multiplier. So this meant that they could be hit or taken out by enemy ground fire, allowing the crewed bomber, the piloted bomber, to get through. Now, the interesting thing here, and something that's often missed about this history, and there's a great new book called Drone War Vietnam by David Katz. Now, what he says in this is that the loyal wingmen drones, these lightning bugs, as they were about to be hit and taken down, they would take an electronic signature, a transmission signature off the missile that was about to hit them, and immediately relay that back to the crewed aircraft, the piloted aircraft. The piloted aircraft would then store that little bit of data, take it back to base, and they would add it to their missile jamming technology. So this meant that the sacrifice of these lightning bug drones wasn't in vain, because it meant that the crewed aircraft could improve their data capability to shield from missiles next time they came in. So that's Vietnam. Let's go back even further. Let's go to the Second World War, let's say. In the Second World War, you had the experimentation with early drone technologies that is actually quite remarkable. I mean, you had the pioneering of early remote control systems here, Charlie. You had people like Joe Kennedy Jr., Joe Kennedy Jr. is the older brother of President JFK. In fact, he was the one who was meant to be tipped to be the future president of the United States. His father was Joe Kennedy Sr., who was the ambassador to the United Kingdom from the United States early on in the war. And he had the choice to go home. He had done his duty. He was in the US Navy. He's done. But he decided instead to try and protect London from the incoming V3 rockets that were propelled from a long-range gun by sending these drones, these B-20 Liberator and B-17 Flying Fortresses, these big iconic bombers that had been completely gutted of everything that was inside of them, filled full of a really potent Torpex explosive. And then a pilot would take them into the sky. The pilot would then eject in a parachute and hand control of these drones to a much bigger plane further back in the sky called a mothership that would then have the pilot take control by remote control of these retrofitted B-20 bombers. And then the aim was to fly them with pinpoint precision into these V3 weapon sites in Mimiec in the south of France. And the drones had a live relay video camera on the end as well, so you could really try and hit with pinpoint precision. Now, in reality, they didn't work very well. They often exploded really... surprisingly, to the point where actually Joe Kennedy Jr. was killed in one of these test flights. And so the mantle of the future presidency was handed down to JFK, of course, who was another war hero out in the Pacific. But that ambition was there to use remote systems to strike targets. And then we can go back even further, Charlie.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask, is it a bit like this sort of this era in World War II? Is it a bit like how Israel protects itself with the Iron Dome? Is it a bit like that, how they fire missiles into other missiles in order to protect? Is it that sort of idea, like a sort of a, was it like a sort of a more backward, more sort of primitive version of that in a way?
I get what you mean, yeah. So this is the kind of age-old cat-and-mouse game of air defense versus air offense. And that's exactly what the Germans were trying to do. They were trying to shoot down these drones before they came in and hit those ground targets, much like Israel does with its Iron Dome today, as it is also under attack by drones and missiles that were coming in. And we saw last year the hundreds of missiles and drones fired all at once into Israel, and the Iron Dome trying to combat those. And the interesting thing there is that some of the drones and missiles continue to get through, even though Israel has the most high-tech air defense system in the world. Yeah. But just to take it back that little bit further, this is the point where we get to the origins of drone warfare, I would say. There was a point in the First World War where the United States joined in 1917. This was a war that the US was never meant to get involved in. You know, the 1823 Monroe Doctrine, the 1904 Roosevelt Corollary, and it's here where we get into that proper history, isn't it? It was here that the United States has stated that they wouldn't get involved in the brutal wars of the European Old World. To be part of the United States was to be something fundamentally different. It was the New World. However, Woodrow Wilson did managed to get the US embroiled in the First World War into that bloody, muddy, entrenched warfare. And towards the end of the war, as 1917 rolled into 1918, we had over 200,000 American casualties. And there were protests in the streets. I've been in the archives in the US going through all these documents about how the US troops were seen as a lost generation coming back in body bags and maimed. I mean, this was a terrible slight on the American people who didn't want to be involved in this war. And it was at this point that early air power thinkers, and you've got to remember, it's only, you know, less than 20 years since the first heavier-than-air flight, the Wright brothers, had even taken place. It was an early fledgling part of the US Army called the US Army Air Service that saw an opportunity. They thought that if they invested in air power, they could create a new type of warfare where that in any future war, they would go over and not through the enemy. They would avoid trench warfare. And they would go over the enemy and hit key industrial targets that they said with pinpoint precision. And by blowing up ammunition factories, oil refineries, rubber factories, places that you make tires and everything you need for the frontline teeth of an enemy's army, by destroying those, you would degrade your enemy's fighting capacity. And so when you met them on the battlefield, finally, they wouldn't have the ability to fight, and you wouldn't have that deep ongoing in trench warfare. You'd walk straight through them quite easily. And in order to try and fulfill that, they started to experiment with even earlier drone technologies. They called them aerial torpedoes. It's called the Kettering bug. And they used these. They took a kind of biplane. They set it on rails, and they had a rotary motor inside and an early Sperry gyroscope to keep it level. And so they wound up this motor, this rotor blade, and they wound it up to the point where they would know how far it would fly. Let's say 100 miles where the target is, and 100 miles away, there's an enemy factory. They'd let it take off on rails. It would fly straight because of that gyroscope. And then once that propeller stopped turning, that was hopefully where the target was, in theory at least. And that would cause a chock to remove, the wings would drop off, and they said it would soar down on its prey like a falcon. Now, in reality, we know this was worse than useless. But again, there was that ambition there, just like Obama's ambition to remove American troops from the cost and risks of warfare. And that's something that maintains today.
It's quite bizarre, really, in a way. I think about it now, but we never really talk about it when we're studying history in school or in any other setting, really, if I'm reading an article, perhaps. We'll never really talk about the use of drone warfare. Do you think that's because it's a very technical sort of aspect of history in a way?
Potentially, yeah, potentially. But seeing as it's now the dominant form of Western warfare, seeing as it's something that taxpayers' money in the UK is being invested in hand over fist, you think it's something that we'd probably talk about. But I wonder if it's because when we were having high counts of fatalities and casualties in Iraq and Afghanistan, the public, the British public, was very involved and critical of the war. Of course, voting publics whose friends and families are dying in distant lands is not going to be popular. But now we're at a state where we can send robots to do our killing for us, which is a weird concept, isn't it? And by doing that, we're removing the democracy, the people like us, out of the decision-making process. It's out of sight, out of mind. We call it warfare by remote control, but there is still killing done in our name all around the world. We just don't know where it is. So it's up to us to make sure that we are putting pressure on our representatives, that there is accountability for these actions, and that we know what is being done around the world in the name of the United Kingdom and Northern Ireland.
I suppose it's important to take responsibility for our actions in terms of how we use these drones and sort of if they're necessary at times, you know. But this leads me on to my next question, which is how come you took such an interest into this part of history, and which is now pretty much, well, you wrote a book on it, am I right? You wrote a book, Death from Above, The Evolution of Drone Warfare. So sort of with those two questions intertwined, those two things intertwined, how come you fell in love with this part of history?
Well, I think fell in love is perhaps a bit strong, but yeah. I definitely became totally fascinated by it, because we reached this point in, like you mentioned at the very beginning, from around 2009, when I was doing my PhD, we reached this point in history where people were being killed on the other side of the world by robots that were being controlled thousands of miles away. I mean, if that isn't going to fascinate you, then I don't know what is, Charlie. It sparked just that moment in history where we could see a new epoch emerging, a whole new era of warfare. And so I wanted to understand that. And so we worked on Death from Above and a new book that's coming out later this year called Precision, A History of American Warfare, that takes us back to 1917 and works our way through. And then we have work that's going on the second drone age. And I run the NATO project on the vulnerabilities of the drone age. And we're looking at the ways in which drones might be used by hostile actors back against Western forces, both now and in the near future.
Incredible. I mean, and another thing to point out, I'm quite interested myself in the Cold War. It's probably my favorite period of history. And how was I know drones were used quite heavily in the Cold War in terms of espionage and, you know, and spying and stuff. When was this at its height, and what was it used for warfare as well? In excluding Vietnam, as we've already spoken about.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it was used in Vietnam, but there was also points at which drones were experimented with to try and provide high altitude surveillance capabilities. So this was most definitely something which, after the shooting down of Gary Powers in his very high altitude spy plane, being paraded on Soviet television and being paraded around the world as a captured American pilot, a lot of people in the US didn't want that to happen again. And so they started to experiment with drones to see if they could replace these very expensive high altitude piloted planes with drone systems. They also started to see the utility of the drone to try and take out tanks. And so drones were experimented and fitted with Hellfire missiles, as both, and the Hellfire missile was created in the 1980s to take out tanks. So drones today are still fitted with Cold War anti-tank technologies. So it's a strange legacy that they're now used for targeted killing of individuals around the world. But the Cold War was most definitely, I suppose you could say, the crucible, the testing stage of modern drone warfare. And that's something that continued through the 90s as well.
So James, do you think you can summarize drone warfare in possibly a minute or two?
Oh, a minute or two. Okay, let me give it a go. To finish off. Well, drones are all about, especially when it comes to the Western side, all about removing the vulnerable human being from the process of killing, all about making sure that we don't put Western troops in harm's way, because we've reached a point in history where we just don't want to be doing that. But in that same vein, what has happened is, as a result of drones being so successful in terms of the US use of them, or at least that's how they're defined in the US and the UK, we've started to see so many other nation states acquiring them around the world. And as a result, we've reached this quite interesting, surprising, and shocking moment in history where drones have come full circle. They were used en masse by the Obama administration to protect troops. And now they are in the hands of Western enemies and used to deploy precision strikes on Western forces. And so I wonder the extent to which, as we move through the 2020s and into the 2030s, drones will come back and become a bit of a menace for Western forces. I mean, just look at January this year. We have seen multiples of attacks on US military bases and on the capital cities of our allies, such as the UAE in Abu Dhabi, by terrorist drones, the Houthi rebels, that are supplied by Iran, which is, of course, one of the West's current hostile actors on its horizon. So I wonder if this is very much a warning sign for the character of future war.
It's a perfect example of history explaining or perhaps posing questions for the future. James, you've been absolutely fantastic, an incredible insight into the history of drone warfare and how it affects us and everything. So thank you very much for coming on, and thank you everyone for listening to the Historic Present.